I'm Tanya. You're back on Soil Series because soil matters. And before we get started, I recognize all of the indigenous people, all of the lands across these planets, past, present, and future. And today we have in the studio back with us.
Hey, here's Kim. Happy to be back.
Kim's looking fabulous today. Do you want to talk us through what you're wearing?
I was thinking of sand today. I think I'm wearing sand.
And is that because you're still flying through the air?
I'm flying still. Last week we shared about our feelings, no, like 2 weeks ago, how we relate to seas and what seas we can connect with, or like, with qualities of seas. And there I was flying the sea. I'm still a bit flying.
And how's your footwear today?
Also quite sandy, or earthy, brown and rounded and bright.
And then, do you want to introduce Deborah? Because I think,
I'm happy to introduce Deborah.
Yeah, and Deborah was here first today. Deborah is particularly maintaining space for us here at the radio. Deborah, thank you so much for coming.
Yeah, I'm happy to share how Deborah and me met. Last year, within the studies, there was the possibility to meet Deborah and Renate in their demo garden in Amsterdam North. It's called Urbania Groove. And we had 4 weeks there together, or like 4 days within 4 weeks of being wild and learning so much about Deborah's practice. And yeah, I'm so happy to have you here today.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
So maybe, do you want to explain a little bit, or do either of you want to explain a little bit about this garden in North?
I can explain. Yeah, it's the Urbania Hoeve Demotown Noord, is what we call it in Dutch. Urbania Hoeve is a foundation I started in 2010 in order to work with local people to transform public space, urban greenery, into high-impact climate adaptation, and by changing soils, by making them edible, by making climate justice in public space. And last years I work with Renate Nolan together on projects in which we do such a thing. So the place in North is 1,200 square meters around a broedplaats, an artist incubator space. It's the garden. And I started transforming it in 2011 together with the microbes and the plants and lots of human animal volunteers into a food forest. And it's now a mature food forest. And what's particularly interesting, there's many interesting things about it. Also, there's a pond that's, I think, almost a year old today. It's, it's 3 days before the pondversary. Yeah. Yeah, it's the kind of, yeah. You know what we'll be doing on Monday. But there's also a soil organism that we jump-started, and by now it's 60 centimeters deep in the space, and it's a very particular soil that is an example of what how you can produce climate adaptation in cities. So it's really, that's like the jewel of the garden, is this beneath your feet, this soil organism of 60 centimeters deep.
Yeah, this is really special. Tanya and me had both had the chance to be in your garden, in your space. And if you are there, you can really not imagine that a few years ago this was, how do you call this, brakke grond, or like a parking lot. Yeah, that's, it's so special now, especially in the summer. It looks
yeah, like a paradise. It's so green, and there's a kids' playground or like a school next to it, and yeah, big, big trees. Yeah.
Yeah, well, it really amazed me about music playing in the background. What really, yeah, something that really amazed me about the soil was that the amount of moisture that it managed to retain. I think we were there on quite a hot day, and in a back corner of the garden, I put my hand into the soil. And yeah, it was just so moisty. And yeah, the soil in my local area really dries out so quickly. It doesn't have this water holding capacity.
Maybe does it has to do with the way that you also plan the space with the paths? Like I observed that the paths are higher than the beds, or most of them.
That's an accident. Well, I mean, an accident that started happening, and then it became too much work to change that, so we just let it happen. But the reason it's so moist is because it's between 15% and 18% organic material in this. That's an unusually high amount. Maybe some tropical soils might have that amount, but they wouldn't be that deep. And this was just built up on a sand soil. And it shows how quickly you can do that if you add plants into the mixture. So these are just, we never dug in the soil. We didn't turn the soil. We just added things on top and let them rot at their own bit and decompose at their own bit.
Ah, thank you. Like, so what role does the compost play in this layering? Or I know that you have a quite big worm compost.
Well, we don't put. It's also there's not enough. I mean, it's quite a large worm bin that we have, and they produce a lot of worm humus. But we don't actually put that on the soil, because there's not. What we do is we use that when we start plants in our greenhouse, and then when we put the plants out, that's how that kind of wormy stuff gets into the soil. But the compost, the plants make the compost themselves, and in the actual food forest, and that's something that came up when we started having the soil scientists from Wageningen measure the qualities of the soil, and they kept on scraping away. We're like, no, don't scrape away. And they're like, yeah, because this is all the litter, or you know, this organic. And I'm like, yeah, but as you can see, the plants consider this soil because they've got roots in it. And you can see little seeds sprouting, and you can see worms living there. So according to these creatures, this is soil. And I know we want to look at something that feels like it's been mineralized, or what's called mineralization. But actually, I think that the creatures that are producing this stuff, they are fine with it. And they have a bank of materials from which they can take when they need it. So it's not like it goes away, and it just stays there until somebody needs it, and somebody wants to do something with it.
Yeah, so interesting. I guess it shows, it's probably, well, it doesn't show, but it might be a reflection of that, where even a soil scientist is so used to looking at these highly cultivated soils where there aren't these natural layers that you would find these layers naturally if you spent a lot of time in a more wildernessy area. But maybe this person being from the Netherlands doesn't have so much access to such a situation. And so for them, yeah, they just don't, they're not familiar with it. So they follow their practice, which makes sense.
Yeah, you see in books about soils, you see always these horizons described, like this is the organic, and then there's these A, B, C, and D, and then there's this parent material.
Oh, I'm sorry, and there's, yeah, I have to speak more into the mic.
there's apparent material. But in our urban situation, we don't have that really. We extract soils from there. We dredge our waters for our ship, you know, industrial part of our urbanization, and we take that slib, that silt, and dump it somewhere. And for example, Amsterdam North is built up from silt from dredging actions, large dredging actions. Amsterdam New West was raised 2 meters by digging out the lake, the Sloter Plas. So I mean, our soils are really highly, in the Netherlands, in our urban areas, they're highly composed. And our organic layers in parks, they're just like recipes. You can literally buy these soils on a menu you go to the soil bank, you can buy a soil, you can buy a certain amount of cubes of it with 3% organic material. So that even is showing how striking it is that these soils have 15%+ organic material in them.
Yeah, it's such a commodification. Like, first we started with the commodification of land, property, but this was kind of whatever happened to be on that land would then be yours. Yeah. And now we have even the overturning and the uprooting and the mixing of the land itself. Even the land gets thrown into some kind of blender and then shipped around. Yeah, a real commodification of like a substance. Almost it feels a bit, when you talk about it like that, like how we think now, you can't buy and sell air. Like the air is just free. It's floating around. And that's how I think kind of about also soil. Like it's like just, it's part of the land, part of the ground, eventually connects to the crust on the core in the middle of the earth. So like that's just there. But then, like, in these situations that you can build up the land 2 meters or take away 2 meters of land also, build a lake if you're interested. It's just, yeah. Dislocated. And the people and the microbes.
And microbes, yes. So this, I think it was last week, a little bit more than a week ago, a very interesting report, not a report, a plan, a methodology was published by the city of Amsterdam about how to design public space in an integrated way. And the authors from the municipality spent a huge amount of time trying to make this in a sort of integral way, thinking of all the verticality of, it's very much infrastructure oriented. So like where are the cable tunnels gonna go, and where's, the water levels, and so trying to pay attention to climate crisis, water level change. But, and it's a really brilliant method, I have to say, but it's called the Integrale Aanpak Ontwerpmethode, the integral approach to designing the public space and all of the factors, because in municipalities, especially in Dutch urban areas, there are different overlapping municipal roles, like people dealing with urban greens, or people dealing with streets, or people dealing with things as assets. They're also overlapping, these roles, there are some important actors, stakeholders that don't have any agency, and also even in this particular. In this particular new method, which is going to be rolling out in October, but we can still give some feedback. And my feedback is going to be that I really need to see more of the voice of the living soil and the roots of the plants, the rhizosphere, with not just single plants, as we have in Amsterdam, like Tree Atlas as well, that it's not just about these trees as assets or water store, you know, soil as water storage or cable tunnel storage, but also that there can be a soil organism that has, because that's how we're going to survive this crisis. We have, we know that we can't let the temperature of our Earth rise more than however many degrees we have left. I think we're already there, but we're already long there. But okay, we're not, we agreed on 2 degrees. But we could also say that for Amsterdam. So if you look at a soil is very much a part of that, what goes on in a soil and how the soil absorbs water and what's growing on a living soil. And you see that in the Demo Garden in Amsterdam North. It's 10 degrees cooler in the summer. And it, in the winter, it's, I don't know if it's 10 degrees warmer, but it's a lot warmer. It doesn't freeze like it does outside. It absorbs all of the water, like you're saying. It's moist, moistish. Even during a 3-month drought, it retains its water. And that provides for a planting that cools the city, keeps the city cool or warm in the winter or buffered from winds. And that kind of, that requires life. And we need to be interacting, in my opinion, with that life and forming really strong bonds, reciprocal relationships to produce that soil. And we all wiggle our fingers in the air.
Yeah, reciprocal relationships with soil. Fantastic. Highlight and underline.
Yeah.
Okay.
So maybe it's always easy to talk here in the radio because it seems we're all quite aware of these topics and like of that the soil is alive and all these microbes, and I'm continuously learning about it. And also maybe in my environment, it's easy to speak in this language. But I'm very curious also how you, Deborah, then communicate with like the gemeente or like these people that are maybe less interested also in the soil as an alive, or like,
Well, so the gemeente is a lot of different people, yeah. And the municipality, and they, and there are also ecologists. There are plenty of people that work in the municipality that are very aware of the living soil. And maybe they're not as freaky as we are.
We can invite them on the radio.
Yes. Oh, you would love some of them. Right. You would really love certain Staatsecologen are just
so cool.
Lovely.
Yeah.
But
Maybe one day we can have you and one or two of people from the gemeente to have a chat on the radio.
That would be great. I'm sure they would love it. They would be very entertaining. And some of them are really mediagenic and so forth. But
why haven't they already been on? That's what
well, they're on. They're on Dutch media. They're on. What am I?
It's not this Dutch media.
Well, I mean, like they. You know. But there are also other people whose role it is to oversee urban greens in public space in different through different lenses, and it's very odd that I'm propping up their roles because I don't always in my professional life find it easy to get along with them. But it's not like they're being unprofessional. They're just fulfilling a role in which, for example, a lawn is an asset, like literally an asset that's described in its length of, and how many different plants are allowed to flourish, and it's not about the soil at all, and that it floods every year. Holy crap, that doesn't matter. And they don't care. That's just like this bother. And why the heck, you know? They're busy with a completely different aspect. They're not stupid. They just have a different, they're part of a different system of where the living quality of the soil is not as important as the fact that it's a football field or that it's green, like a carpet in the city. So there's that is changing, fortunately. The view of Amsterdam is changing to a more ecological one, and we can be really happy about that, but it has to be much, 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 much more, even than the stated ambitions.
And then, well, I noticed you pulled out some pieces of paper here. What's going on there? And what prompted you to pull them out? And what are they? They're beautiful, circular, patterns, images.
Yeah, these are soil chromatograms. These are tiny little soil chromatograms. This is a portion of the soil study that was carried out by the entire community of practice of Amsterdam South Oost Voedselbos, Food Forest. So there's a group of people, about 60 people all together, and they've been making soil samples of the whole, this 55 hectare area, which is going to become a food forest. And I see some of them look a lot alike, but I just pulled them at random, actually. But there's about five different typologies of soil in Amsterdam's Zuidoost, and these are some of them. Like these are the, this is a really good example. This is a these are soil samples. Well, you can see that there's a lot of organic material, not a lot of soil life, but the organic material hasn't been, accessed yet by the soil life. This is a more mineral, like a sandy layer of the soil, but there's a ton of mineral life a ton of microbial life, considering that it's not got a lot of organic material. Kind of funny. And
maybe we need to say some words to them, to make them. I'm super fascinated. Like Deborah just places them on my arm here in the studio, and it's very stunning how they look. Like I've never seen this in real life before. I'm really fascinated. So it looks almost a bit like a flower or so. With brown, almost purple colors and green shades. And then in the middle, there is always a hole. Deborah, what does that...
So these are soil chromatograms. Soil chromatograms is an old technique in which you take a soil sample, just some dirt, you grind it up really fine, and you mix it with a sort of, let's just say, a soapy kind of solution. I'm really cutting to the chase. And then this hole in the middle of this piece of paper, you put a little filter, and then you place this horizontal, this little, say, 15 by 15 piece of scientific filter paper, with the filter, with the like a cigarette filter in the middle in that hole, and you place that over a little basin with that soil solution that you made, and it absorbs it up like an inkblot, and then it spreads out over the paper. But I forgot to say that you make the paper light sensitive, so that's got also some silver nitrate in the paper too, so that in the course of 2 or 3 days this image appears, and what you can see is what the materials in this ink blot, in this spreading spot. So on the outside, you'll have the lightest materials. So those are the organic materials. And in the middle, like this one, you can see it really clearly. In the middle, you have the mineral materials. They're heavy, like sand, and they're heavy, so they don't travel as far. And then these vertical stripes are the enzymes. They're the traces of the dead microbial, now dead, unfortunately, in the making of the sample, beasts that you could never have seen with your own eyes, but you can see that they were here because they leave these, say, proteinous traces in the material.
Tanya, are you familiar with this technique?
No, I don't know it. It's fantastic. I really want to try.
Yeah, we'll do it sometime.
Fantastic. Yeah, I would love to try the Green Tribe.
Yeah, we should almost take a picture and then we put it on our Mixcloud account, maybe as the cover picture of today's radio, so you can have a look at it as well, listeners.
Nice idea. So these all come from the Bijlmer.
And these were dug up by just people living there who are all now working for quite some time to produce this very large, well, for us, the largest scale food forest, maybe even in the world, 55 hectare in the existing public space.
Mm. Whoa. Woo, the Bijlmer, 55 hectare. Woo. So then I want to ask you a little bit, a little bit about maybe earlier in your life before you became fascinated with food forests. Like, what was your, what was your childhood like? And what was the role of like soil and land and nature way back then?
I grew up in California. I was born in Southern California in the desert. And Kim, you're my spirit sand. And you're the sunset of the desert. And my father is a geologist. And he worked on large water infrastructure projects in California. So California, for people who don't know, it's the, I don't know if it still is, but I think so, it's the largest agricultural entity in the world. So it's like it produces enormous amounts of food, bigger than, as if it were a nation state, actually, at that level. And also it has, the moisture is not equally distributed through the state, and the kinds of economies are not equal, as economies are never equally distributed. There also the water and the agriculture is not equally distributed. We have the Central Valley. So there's enormous water infrastructure that goes into producing this agriculture. And my father was involved in this typical industrial well, it wasn't for it was for everything, but also for the urbanization, just the urbanization of nature through water infrastructure. And he had a fascination, obviously, with his job. And he brought my brother and I always to these sites where they were producing what are called earth-fill dams. An earth-fill dam looks like a lake, but it's a it's water storage. Looks like a lake landscape. And it's a way of storing water without using a lot of cement. But that doesn't mean that the materials that you use to make that basin, how they can be enormous, you know, doesn't mean that they are coming from that area. Obviously, it's cheaper if they are, but, you know, there's huge extraction going on, clay from here, sand from here, boulders from here, and blah, 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 from everywhere. So, anyway, we got to see, I grew up seeing that a lot. I grew up in places where, then we moved to different places also. We moved to Northern California. We had always, we always grew our own food because that's back in the day what you did and you can. And we weren't, I didn't come from like any kind of hippie family or anything, but you just had fruit trees and you just had the ability to grow food and we did. And also, we lived, the place where my parents live now, where we also lived for some years, my brother and I, it was on a hill, and the hydrology of the hill was such that it needed, the drainage was not optimal. And the soil, the land was very, let's say, young and volatile. And there was always a risk that the house, there would be a landslide and the house would slide down. And as a family, we restructured this hill, the hydrology of the mount, to say mount, it sounds much bigger than it is, but we restructured the hydrology by hand to make a different water drainage to keep the soils in fact, dry, to redirect that water to an underground river, and which was a creek later down the mountain, and so forth. And so I grew up with these, this is a very small scale land project, but actually for some people that would be considered a big one. We did it by hand. So I was accustomed to seeing large scale infrastructures, and as a family producing our own water infrastructures, land infrastructure.
Would you call it an intervention?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty major one.
Mm-hmm. Okay, super interesting. And then so you had this, like, I guess it maybe it left you with a feeling of you can interact with nature. Like, you'd already just had the experience, whereas other people maybe go their whole lives without really interacting with the land around them.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to say that that always happens in a good way, or even that I do it always in a good way, but I grew up in an environment where a heavy hand was quite okay. So, yeah.
Okay, and then at one point, I think you went to art school.
Oh. Skip, there's a few lives in between, but yes, I went to art school, and
do you want to mention the other lives? No? You were working as an accountant in a big law firm.
No, I mean, I just had some different personas along the way, and then... And not interesting for this particular day. And then I went to the Art Academy indeed, to the Rietvelds. And I used to, I was working with public space always, but at that time it was the internet that was my public space. And after some years of that, of early internet art work, I remembered my past, and I started missing the food and the material, the part of life, and had to dive back into that. So say from about 2002, I started going back to the physical world.
So, two questions. So how old were you when you went to art school?
Old.
Wow, that's so inspiring. That's just so much more significant. It means so much more, I think, when you do it later in life, when you make a corner.
Yeah, actually, I wasn't that old. I was maybe...
19, I did everything.
No, I was at that time, in fact, Renata and I were the oldest students at the time. And I mean, maybe she was like a half a minute older than I... And that she's a little bit older than I am, but not by much. Anyway, and I was 28 when I started art school, and it was as if I was a grandma.
Yeah, I can imagine.
It's not important. Maybe it's not important, but yeah, I can relate to you. Yeah, a lot.
And then how was it then making this corner? And maybe we can play a song in a moment, have a little tea break. How was it then making this corner back to soil, and like what was the role of nature at the Rietveld at that time, and how did that come into like their approach to art, and like what kind of access do you have to art that was like in this domain or people having this conversation?
Well, that's a funny question. I mean, the turning the corner to go to art school, that happened very organically. Yeah. It didn't seem weird to me. It would just seem weird to other people. But
can you give a short explanation?
Well, I mean, I was the only one that old that had that background. People will remark, oh, isn't that strange to go... To back to, also now I do a PhD, and people also make the weirdest comments that that's a funny thing to do at my age.
Some people spend their whole lives trying to finish their PhD.
I just started, so.
Yeah, I know, but like, I think, yeah. Like, I know people, yeah, I think also people do PhDs in their retirement. Not that you're that old.
Deborah's not going to be retiring, I can imagine. Composting, always. Reliving. Yeah, I'm here in space with two PhD students, actually. Students? You don't say that. Candidates. I'm sorry. Yeah. Yeah, should we go to a song? And I think Deborah brought one in, but we're not sure if this is the moment for it. Maybe later. Yeah, we're going to go for it. So thank you for tuning in to... Soil Matters, and now you're gonna hear in a second a song now.
Cold has set to hold. Change. The food in my school make it good. Get that fake food up out of my hood. Hope the message not misunderstood. Grow and cook your own food, yes you could. Got the little homies in the garden. Got the big homies selling collard greens. In the north side ain't starving since community cooks been on the scene.
Dreaming hot Cheetos and Takis, boy, you better eat your broccoli. That food is kinda like putting poison in your brain. Need more people at the club popping bottles of that water, dabbing on that fast food. Veggies out the garden, I go hard, I eat good, and I put that on my mama, eating healthy school lunch, and that's word to Miss Obama, drinking water, living longer, no process drama, call me John Deere, shawty, I be growing like a farmer, dad.
Boom, 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 ASC got produce, ASC about to go cool, we gone, boom, boom. Boom. ASC got Purdue. ASC about to go cool. Whipping in the kitchen, whipping in the kitchen. Boom. I be whipping in the kitchen, whipping in the kitchen. Boom. Chop it up, chop it, chop it, chop it, chop it up. It's slow food got you sloppy, bruh. So chop it, chop it, chop it, chop it up.
I get the C from the oranges. I get the B from the broccoli. I get the A from the milk. I get my vitamins properly. My food be packed with the minerals. I hope you taking this literal. So when you 65 plus, you should be passing your physical. Try tell them, try tell them. But they did not believe me. All that sugar was sweet. Said I got diabetes. You better rethink your drink. This stuff is not what you think. Get you some water or something. I get it free. the sink. Keep it healthy, but still got that good taste. Got an appetite for flavor and an appetite for taste. If you need a couple pointers, I can get you some help. And then I see you on the back. Cause you need some milk.
Living your role with some big dreams. About to make it big on the big screen. Don't pay attention to that TV. Cause fake food ain't what you need. Come on the house, let us chop it up. That's been telling me spin it popular. The youth are the truth and don't stop it up. The youth are the truth and don't stop it up. But the health, wealth, social change. My fruits and veggies be off the chain. Want real food for real people. Gonna break your bread. Cafe. Move money, real money, that's all I need. Get the green.
Got it. People got it. Go food. Go food. ASE got produce. ASE about to go cool. We gone. Go food. Go food. ASE got produce. ASE about to go cool. Whipping in the kitchen. Whipping in the kitchen. I be whipping in the kitchen. Whipping in the kitchen. Chop it up, chop it, chop it, chop it, chop it up. The slow food got you sloppy, bruh. So chop it, chop it, chop it, chop it up. Go food, go, 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 go. Go food, go, 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 go. Chop it up, chop it, chop it, chop it, chop it up. The slow food got you sloppy, bruh. So chop it, chop it, chop it, chop it up.
Oh, that was faster than expected, but now we are back after a little break of some drinks. And yeah, like once it is open again in the Binnenpret, just come for a super cheap Club Mate or another drink. Like it's just lovely here. And yeah, the garden is fantastic. Come check it out. And I just wanted to share the titles of the song. One was by Hiatus Coyote. Called Borderline with My Atoms. And the other one, I maybe said it wrong. I just hear them talking, you know. Okay, and the other one is called Grow Food, and the band is called Appetite for Change. What did you want to do? How do you say the band's name? Or
I always say Hiatus Coyote.
Oh
but
my god, it was cooler.
No, that's what I thought about how you said it. That's what I thought about. That's what I thought about you. Yeah, but okay, where were we? We spoke a little bit about the Rietveld, and yeah, you took this corner, went into art school, and yeah, and then I think I asked you a little bit about, but how was that, what space was there for you to then like take the corner of going into like more soil or nature? Do you want to speak about that?
Yeah, very briefly, because actually that's not how I got out of there. But anyway, there was a point in time when I was working with another student, actually. We were doing really some fun, quite some funny land art things in retrospect. Like we were, we did these during a month, no, during a week-long a workshop in Portland.
My mind is closing. He is an astrophysics man.
Architects Bone and Villeune, and then doing my own projects in working in Rotterdam and The Hague, and that's how it started. And so it started out actually with food, and then through food and these physical projects, I mean, it just became so. Once you start to try to produce food system infrastructure, you stumble very quickly upon the soil. And there was this urban agriculture research, but it was very much focused on like temporary situations and selling pizza and beer to activate these spaces, something I really hate. and because it takes people away from the core activity. And then, so I was into working, and because I work in the public space with local people in their community, it's just, you need to produce a living soil. So it just was very logical and organic that way. So from 2010, I started Urbania Huva, which means the city is our farmyard, and which sees public space as a place to produce this climate crisis adaptation and food justice, climate justice with local people.
Thank you for that. So interesting. And I had, we talked a bit about it also before, but now you are also part of participating for the Dutch Pavilion at the Venice Architectural Biennale. And would you like to share something about that work as well?
I'm one of two people that will be exhibiting, or there are many people will be involved, of course, and we were chosen by the Het Nieuwe Instituut. Actually, our themes, our research themes were chosen. So that's actually a more accurate way of putting it. And my research theme that will be shown there is called multi-species urbanism. And so multi-species urbanism is about producing a different kind of urbanism. Urbanism, as we know now, is not only about cities. It's a global phenomenon. What we do when we think we're building cities also affects the entire planet. This also has been known since for many hundreds of years, but we still have to theoretically keep going back to this point that there's no division between nature and society, and how and that things are actually radically connected for good and for worse. But multi-species urbanism proposes a radical change in the way we relate to the natural world in creating reciprocal relations, and that should be the driving force of all urbanization efforts. And that if we do that, and there are practical examples, practical methodologies, and proposals for how this could happen. If we do that, then we can save ourselves from climate crisis and all these injustices and even distribution of resources.
Thank you for this information. Could I ask the other scientist here, what you think about what Deborah just said? Like, you have all these facts also with you.
I think what Deborah just shared makes from a scientific perspective is very well backed up, and a lot of things that have been shared today are incredibly well backed up. Like, we know very concretely about the urban heat island effect. We know about that soils that soil moisture is incredibly important for biodiversity in the soil. And we know, one thing I think we struggle to come to terms with is to really pinpoint why biodiversity is important. I think people don't really actually, I think there's very few satisfactory answers out there. A lot of people say biodiversity is so important. What's the biodiversity here? We need to maintain biodiversity. I think not many people understand why. And I think a large part is because a huge motivation for protecting the biodiversity is egocentric. Just because we like the image. Sorry, I'm going on a tangent now. Just because we like the image that we have. And so we want to maintain this level of biodiversity. Not even more, not less, but this level, what we see. So it's just maintaining a stable place for ourselves.
Super interesting. If I think back of the image that you brought in later, earlier, about the mixer, that you pull everything in the blender, like the soil, and then you press the start button and then biodiversity of soil. What could we share about that in cities?
Well, the biodiversity in soil is incredibly important because this is the starting point, or it's an earlier starting point of biodiversity than when we normally talk about biodiversity. We normally talk about biodiversity in terms of the plants and the animals, fauna and flora. But actually, if we were to lose that biodiversity, if we still have the microbial biodiversity, we can recreate these diverse ecosystems. We have the tools and the foundations to do so. But if we lose the bacteria, we can really try to... It's going to be a lot harder to go the other way around. I don't know if it's possible or not. But, yeah, it's really with this bacteria, this creates the healthy habitat for the forests, for the ecosystems that grow on top of the surface, creates the foundation. So, in terms of, I think, having this holistic living where we don't only look at humans and directly at the health of humans, where we look at the full picture and humans are a part of that, as are other beings, then I definitely creating, yeah, the urban food forest or the urban farm is like one way of doing that. Personally, I don't eat meat, but actually I don't think vegetarianism or veganism is about eating meat or not. It's about creating a healthier way of living, of living and consuming produce and fueling ourselves. And I think if we kind of had the block next to us as like our farm that we farmed communally and there were animals living happily there, I don't see why we should prioritize the life of sacrifice the life of plants above the life of an animal. I don't see this, personally, I don't see this hierarchy. Maybe that's a bit controversial. And I don't eat meat in the current situation either. So, like, I'm not, yeah, so I do make this hierarchy in the current situation, which I'm not, yeah. But I think, indeed, changing this paradigm so we care even for the rocks, which are perhaps really non-living, but they do have the minerals that then feed back into the living world or perhaps one day become part of the living world. Like, I think this is just so necessary to expand our view. And I think, yeah, I don't know if, like, the urban food farm is, like, the be-all and end-all, but it's, a major, fantastic step forward to changing this thinking. Yeah.
Yeah, with the urban food forest or farms or what foraging commons can provide... are also other kinds of health, like mental health, different kinds of engagement, which radically change how we consume other things. Like at the beginning of the COVID lockdown in the Netherlands, as soft as it was, we still call it a lockdown, there was this hoarding moment, and there are food deserts in Amsterdam. There are places that are not in the center where it's, for example, in Amsterdam Zuidoost, where it's really hard to get fantastic vegetables like we get here in the more central parts inside the periphery, say. And except for in Amsterdam Zuidoost, there was so much just growing wild. And people in the community of practice, they know this. They know to forage for winterpostelijn and rucola and all these delicious leafy greens that you can just take, and they are so nutritious at that time. And that's the time you need nutrition, and you need vitamin D from the sun. You need to go outside and pluck things and have a meaningful relationship with your bosplantsoen, with your outdoor woodland forest, and get, you know, fresh air, sunlight, and extremely fresh and free food. Yeah.
So these are like these foraging commons, aside from the microbes and the molds. I know that has a bad connotation, but we need these and the pollens and all. This is activating our. It's proven to activate our immune systems in a positive way. Also, the foods that one forages in a food forest, they're not kilocalorie foods. They don't stick to your ribs, but they are high value nutrition, and they can be high value protein. They are things that people who don't have a lot of money would never buy, but they are the highest value nutrition that you could get if money were no object, and they're also a source of joy, and they're a source of conviviality. So it's a way of interacting and feeling safe in the public space, because that's another thing in many urban environments, people don't feel safe in their public space. One of the groups we work with in our community of practice, before they started going around and working within this group to design how they saw this urban food forest from their perspective and how they wanted to design it, they used to walk around with a police officer in Amsterdam Zuidoost. There are some funny things that appear in the news in Amsterdam Zuidoost, but as a woman, I can tell you it's a perfectly safe place to be. And they were walking around with a police officer and feeling that it wasn't safe, and creating a practice of it not being safe. But since they are now designing their own public space, since they forage there, since they go, they use it in a different way, since they have a different relationship, suddenly it's a safe space. That's valuable.
Yeah, that touches me a lot. I'm gonna try and say this without crying now, but but I actually grew up in a. I grew up in an area where, well, maybe I felt, I don't know if I felt safe, but I wasn't kind of notably not safe, in that I had a lot of a few physical interactions with people on the street, and like one time was just like totally bashed by a group, in the middle of the day. So I think, and I guess in my adult life. Then I come to think a little bit about like what to do with, like, obviously the area, I don't know about obviously, but the area has improved a bit, not a lot, but a bit. And I guess thinking like, wow, one day, like, I would really like to give something to this area, because, yeah, I know what it was like growing up there and feeling afraid to like look other people in the eye when you walk around on the street, so it really touches me to then hear that there is like an example of a project that kind of speaks to that.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing that. These things are precarious. We have to keep them up. We have to defend them and insist. We have to struggle that we want our public space to be this way. Yeah. And it kind of veers from the soil, but the soil is what makes it happen, because that's the place. If we grow that, then we grow these spaces in this different way. We produce this kind of interaction amongst each other. We eat from it together. Mm. We care for it together. And the soil likes to be cared for.
Yeah, that's such a lovely phrase, that the soil likes to be cared for. Yeah. Did you want to say something?
Yeah, thank you both for sharing these stories. I just wanted to also come back to how Deborah figured a way to approach space, because sometimes if you come to a new city, or you come to an area where you maybe don't feel comfortable, or you're not familiar with your surrounding, then I found it so beautiful to what I got introduced by Deborah in Urbania Hoeve. And maybe you feel like sharing some words about it. And
thank you for Renata and I have a methodology which we call radical observation.
Woo!
and and we these are about 33 exercises. Let's see, actually maybe more by now, but that's it's always expanding. They're sort of like asanas, like yoga asanas, that you get into alone and quiet in silence to explore some part of a space that you're eventually planning to do an intervention in. So it's not just for observing, just for observing's sake. You're thinking maybe to do some kind of intervention. So this is your way to get to know it. And Kim, you participated with the Rietveld students in this one that was called the Practicing April, the April Praxis. And the job of the April Praxis was to stop May. Everybody failed miserably. Yeah. It was good. But the point was to throw your body into these relationships with the ecosystem so that you could stop succession, the ecological succession. So that's the kind of that's how radical they are sometimes, and you will fail. Or there's another one that we should all be doing now, but then we maybe can get to it. It's called 24, and then this time when there's light late at night, so you go to, in the course of a month, you try to go to observe the space for about an hour a day, mm-hmm. silently sitting, not doing anything, just observing, which is a lot. What happens at every hour, but every day a different hour. So also what happens at 4 in the afternoon, but also what happens at 4 in the morning, or 10 o'clock at night, or 2 in the morning, or 7 in the morning, or that kind of thing. And you see the most amazing things. And it really, it's funny because it seems like it's comprehensive, like you'll get some kind of comprehensive view, but in fact you immediately realize that you'll never get a comprehensive view. But at least it starts to show you some actors, and it shows you how you perceive the actors, who is important to you, and how you can remember what's going on. You learn to observe how you remember this list, because during radical observation, you don't take notes. You just try to teach yourself to remember and to be impressed by what impresses you. And
that was a really important first step to really approach this space, also when we were doing these exercises last spring. And what I liked so much, that we were a group of Rietveld students, and some of us had maybe never actively thought about green space before, I don't know. And this exercise that you did with us really allowed us to meet the space and to realize that we already know so much, or we learn so much by just observing without imposing ourselves immediately into the space. And this first step I found so strong, like so strong. Yeah.
Yeah, thank you. It is, it's really a useful thing to know, because when we design public space with local people, the group that comes to participate in this, they all have different skills. Yeah. And some of them are gardeners, and they know everything. They know all the things about the trees, and they know about meadowlands and mowing rituals. Or maybe they were an educator, and they were teaching the people from Pantar, or the certain municipal stewarding maintenance organizations to how to do things in a way that maybe we think now is old-fashioned. Or maybe they were an elementary school teacher or a nurse or whatever, but they know everybody in the neighborhood, but they know nothing about plants. And then suddenly we all have to work together to make a good design that's going to be able to be maintained by the neighborhood, and we have to use all of the skills available. And so this method gets everybody fairly quickly on the same page, right now for Venice, we're working with a group in Venice called We Are Here Venice. And they are doing radical observation in a place called the Green Triangle that they're going to convert in the course of the next year. And they're into a, we don't know yet, they're learning. And they developed some of their own radical observations because we wanted to jumpstart them as a group. So because they're really diverse, the group of people, and also in their relationship to Venice. And so we spend time with them. Actually, my partner there from We Are Here Venice, So-Yong Han, and they do a radical observation where they don't only just observe, they learn to report to each other what they observed, and then they report back to the group. So you never report your own report. People learn to proxy each other.
Fantastic. And then to bring it back to the text that you brought in today, which, well, you kind of suggested three different texts, but all by the same author, and I'm not sure how to pronounce the name, Maria Praag de la Balacasa, and she talks a lot about our relationship with soil.
Yeah.
And yeah, how do you perceive what her philosophy? Maybe you want to say a couple of words.
First I want to say about, I would call her Maria Puig de la Balacasa, but that's how I say her name. Well, we don't know if that's correct. No, the reason I think she's important is she marks a new stage in soil science, which used to be more about geology. And then in the 70s, 80s, biology starts to creep in to soil science. And also women start to creep into soil science. So it was a male field, and then it becomes more women becoming involved that are women that are interested in life. So these are the soil biologists. Elaine Ingham is probably one of the most famous. Mm-hmm. And then we start having with Maria Puig de la Balacasa, we have the social sciences coming in, and science and technology studies. That's what her main contribution is. She adds this, and it's completely accepted, yeah. Increasingly accepted that this is also soil science, so much so that even people from Wageningen can consider me a soil expert, which is unthinkable 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And but that's the work that she brings in. So her, one of the things that she, well, she's a genius. Maria! She writes about care.
I've got her book here, and it's titled Matters of Care. And I think it's from maybe 2017-ish. I don't find it now. Maybe 2016. No, 2017. Yeah, Matters of Care. And then I think she has a forthcoming book as well,
yeah,
which yeah
will also be about care and soil,
which I'm very interested in. Okay, yeah, but well, first tell. Do you want to tell about her philosophy, or I can say?
Yeah, you say.
All right, I'll say. Well, so in Matters of Care, she really is talking about, I don't know if, yeah, she's talking about the need to care for the soil, and that we need to move from conventional agricultural practices to a more holistic thinking. What, though, I think it was a little short in not quite, I don't think she really explained that it needs to be a reciprocal relationship, or I don't think she adequately recognize that, from, because I think everything she says in this book is fantastic, but it doesn't say it. It still talks about the need to care for the soil, to me, as being egocentric, as being for the benefit of
agriculture in the end, that to have a holistic care benefits agriculture, and that's why we should do it.
Yeah, but she talks about how do I explain this? Well, the temporality of the care. So she contrasts it with the productionist or productivist tempo and reasoning rationale of industrial agriculture, and that formed our soil science and notions of even, like I described earlier, what is soil and what isn't soil. And so now that's changing because of people like her.
Yeah, and I think her book is, yeah, really, well, I found it really seminal to read. Like, I've never read this combination of caring for oneself, of caring for one's environment, and to bring in also the science itself, and to recognize the field and the farmers and everyone involved. I also think that actually, I read maybe a blog post of hers also, that I feel like she's also shifting. Maybe we're all just along on a parallel line to like this more reciprocal relationship, and like I think maybe that's what I got, and that so then I'm excited to read the next book because I hope that it kind of takes this point like a bit further, because I think like this book is like this huge step, and then I think to recognize perhaps like this reciprocal relationship a bit more is then just like wow, like perfect.
There are also Marxian theorists sorry about that that write about the labor of the non-human animals as actual labor, and maybe I'll be the one who writes about that about that reciprocity for that labor. Like we say it in permaculture and agroecology and urban political agroecology, we say those words in a kind of funny way in practical context. We say you should always let the nature do the work because it's got 24/7, but nature is laboring, it's labor. And you like to be paid for your labor, and also nature needs to be, from my perspective, also needs to be paid or get something out of its labor. Maybe less struggle, for example.
And so, what do you think about, like, I kind of want to ask, how can we then, like, hug nature? And does nature want to be hugged? And how can we, like, get consent from nature to hug it?
It's so funny that you asked this question. When you were talking, I had such a feeling of, like, putting my belly on the earth. So we want to know, Deborah. Yeah.
Well, I don't know if I should be the word on consent, speaking for... the consensual, when that would be consensual. I mean, I can hardly imagine nature would notice.
Hardly imagine nature's gonna mind.
Yeah, exactly.
She loves it.
Yeah. I think that the idea that it brings in us that we. That the anthropomorphization can be also positive. Who was writing? I was reading someone about writing about that, some kind of positive anthropomorphization. I will have to get back to you on that. But that's not only a bad thing, and that's when you give a thing human qualities, like as if the soil, which is a zillion uncountable things, could have the same kind of human perceptions and then decide that it liked or didn't like. But we can know when things are stressed and don't like things. I mean, we can know when we're killing things. And so there's there's a place for anthropomorphization also in the way we relate to things. That is not, there is theory for it not being completely dismissible. But I don't have at hand the theorist.
Yeah, also something that maybe shows up in your practice or in the radical observation, I think, like, again, like the approaching of the space, like to first observe and take a step back instead of like fully going for it and like putting your belly on the soil or whatever, even if it's with sweet attentions or kind attentions.
But like, did you ever do a radical observation that it didn't yield a surprise?
Yeah, I don't know. No, I don't. Yeah.
For me, I mean, I do it. Sorry, maybe that's not a fair kind of question. But for me, when I do radical observation, when I enter my space, I always go to the space thing. Okay, today I'm going to do blah 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 blah. And then I'm always wrong. I mean, I always observe, and then I say, oh, I'm led to do something else because of the observations at that time.
Yeah, maybe we talk about the needs of the soil or like the wishes, and that we don't know them maybe. But then we also arrive in the garden or in the public space with our own needs and wishes. Yeah. And then the first step is maybe to acknowledge them. And then we come back to this like non-violence communication, like, okay, I feel you, I hear you. And then also open yourself to to the soil or to the space.
And how can you be in the space and have your needs met and the needs of the soil simultaneously? Yeah, and hopefully bring joy to both. Woo! That's the idea.
Well, climate catastrophe, it's a really good question with soils and with, like, I think it is pretty fair to say we can add organic material, give organic material to these microbes, to these beasts that adore it, and allow them to proliferate so that they can produce soils that contain more moisture and can support a cooler woodland ecosystems in our cities, which cool our cities and store our carbon and water events. I don't see that as conflictual at all.
And then we've also, we've mentioned the environmental justice movement a few times. And do you think like this, I've heard conflicting arguments that some people really support it, but other people and think this gives voice to the environment and also maybe to people of color and indigenous people. But then I also hear people criticizing and saying that, well, this is actually a movement that was created for white people to feel good about protecting nature and to just almost commodify nature even further in a way. Do you have a perspective on this?
Well, it's all of those things. I mean, in my opinion, and there are conservation happens in all different forms, and also indeed deleterious to indigenous populations, and very much for sometimes, not always, but mostly to reproduce colonial landscapes and colonialisms, absolutely. That doesn't mean we need to throw the baby out with the bathwater in terms of all kinds of conservation landscapes. There's a great book on this very subject called The Conservation Revolution by Robert Fletcher and Bram Bisker. And that's, I have the ebook.
Oh, great.
I'll send you the ebook. that write about exactly that problem, and that's also the book where they write about these different kinds of anthropomorphization, I believe, as well. Yeah, but no, it's a complex thing. Also, like I I didn't. For example, it's good to be having those conversations, though. For example, ecologists, like when you start to think about urban soils and what kind of landscapes you want to produce in these public space places, there will be conflicting opinions about it. Like, do we preserve these in Haimsa, these native species, or do we produce carbon storage, water storage landscapes? That's going to be a massive discussion, I would say. Probably more than other people would want me to say, including my own partner in Urbania Hoover. I would say the time of the Inhamsa, the native species, poor soil landscapes, concerning the seriousness of our climate crisis and disaster that is pending, I would say it might not be the best time to be worrying about those sandy landscape plants. I would say store the carbon, store the water, and put that stuff in a seed bank in some place and keep it growing, but the big spaces need to be storing carbon. All the space needs to be storing carbon and water. That produces a very different kind of landscape, and that many ecologists would absolutely disagree with me on that position.
Oh, very interesting point. I'm curious what you think about it.
Yeah, I think I'm in two minds, because I think what I see in the Netherlands, you can go to some conservation areas and they have these rare plants. These really, really rare plants, like, that are on the Europa 2000 list, and it's fantastic. But it's also so managed. They filter their water.
Yeah.
It's a museum.
Yeah.
Like, it's an outdoor museum. And at one, I think, yeah, like, but so in this situation, it's kind of like, well, what are we conserving in the end?
Yeah.
This is our idea of nature, and it's not actually natural. We've created an outdoor museum here. And also on Tessel, what's the name of this delta? There's an estuary. And the estuary naturally moves. It shifts up the island. But because they want to maintain tourism and they want to, and they've got all their walking paths and their signage, they keep the, every 7 years, they re-dig the estuary, and it looks so natural. Like, I've been there, it looks... It's like where the ocean meets the inland water.
The water system.
Kind of like where a river system also meets the ocean, and there's a lot of water and some sandy areas usually, and it's like an intertidal zone. And so every 7 years they redig this and they say they're conserving nature, right? And it is conserving. It is very much conserving. It's conserving one image of how this place should look, and I think that is for me that's too far. On the other hand, yeah, and so that these are examples from the Netherlands. And then on the other hand, when I think of Australia and I think of areas where you walk into, and I'm sure also in the North and South Americas, that you can't see evidence of humans being there. You can walk to areas where maybe was there ever a human on that spot? Like in some gorges or very extreme places, remote places to get to. Some canyons, perhaps, like that are just unreal in the middle, like not even a walking path to get there. You would just have to walk off through forest, you know. And then I think, well, those places, for sure, I'm going to protest if someone tries to cut those trees down or tries to disrupt them.
But here's a challenge, and let's talk about Australia, which is, I was there in 2016 as an urban agriculture delegate from the Netherlands. And I learned there about Bruce Pascoe, who wrote Dark Emu, Black Seeds of Dark Emu Black Seeds, about how this notion of the hunter-gatherer, like this trope, this hunter, and was obscuring the fact that Aboriginal peoples were producing agriculture in Australia for about 60,000 years, okay? And it was very quickly destroyed by colonial savages. Within weeks, literally within weeks. And one thing that wasn't so savage about these savages is that they were making watercolors and keeping journals. So they were watching it being destroyed by their herd animals, their sheep, in fact, coming off the boats when they landed, and like devastating a landscape really quickly. So about these converted landscapes, what is now a holy desert in the center of Australia was not, when it was under Aboriginal stewardship in these 60,000 years, it was the grain, it was a perennial, it was the place where the perennial grains were growing. It was the breadbasket. So what would we say? What would you say? It's a lot. It's too challenging, I know. But like, what would you say about converting this landscape? Because now it is a holy desert and has holy memories and life there. But it used to be ecologically more, and it used to feed people more. What would you say about how that could be developed in a utopia?
Yeah, I guess, I think the desert is a beautiful and striking and powerful place. I think that I wonder, I've read the book also, and, well, I'm not opposed, definitely not opposed to it. I also don't, I'm not sure what you mean by the desert, and if you mean like the entire desert in Australia, and I just think that the rainfall is not adequate everywhere, or yeah.
It can be brought back.
It can be brought back. That is very true. Yeah. Yeah.
Trees.
Yeah. That is true. It's very, very true. And yeah, in Australia, there's also this classic example, because we have this silly thing called a rabbit-proof fence that runs like thousands of kilometers, and it was literally to keep the rabbits out, and but it's just like this wire fence with like goes through the middle of nowhere, but it means on one side of the fence there this it's where there are there are like the sheep and the cattle and these grazing animals. And on the other side, there is none of that. And so on one side, there is vegetation. And on the other side, there is no vegetation. And there's a line. And you can, there's all these, it's famous because there's photos and you see clouds on one side of the fence and no clouds on the other. And there are thousands of photos. Like, it's not just the once, and it's like a weird occurrence. When do you look up into the sky and see the sky divided by a fence on the ground? So yeah, it's very the power of powering plants, of planting plants is amazing. So I would say go for it. especially if it was to also incorporate the same people and the same vegetation that was used for agriculture. I think in these last few months they've had their first kind of large scale kangaroo grass crop, which they use for the seeds and make something something similar to wheat and you can grind up for to make flour. So I think if it was to incorporate the knowledge and the people and the landscape, I would say go for it. Mm. Cutting down trees, I'm still like, that would be an even more difficult question.
Why would you need to cut down trees?
Well, I don't know, just if you're like saying like we should convert that landscape into ones that are more yeah, I don't know, productive or so.
Well, the way when back in the day, 60,000 years ago, there was, I mean, there were trees in, it was a food forest. I mean,
it was a food forest.
That they were growing, you can grow grains, you can have large swathes of perennial grains in areas where you're also having trees. It's not, you don't need to do
what we do.
Yeah. So, and as we all know, trees bring rain by planting, like as you said, even just this fence can create the vegetation, this lower vegetation creates a different hydrological cycle with clouds on one side and none on the other. And trees do that even more. And the soil organism is also part of that. And the soil seed bank, therefore, and so forth.
Yeah, fantastic. Then I say yes. Yay! I say, let's call Bruce. Let's get Bruce on the line. Bruce. Let's combine forces. How are we for time? I can't see anywhere. But yeah.
We have 25 minutes left.
All right. Yeah, do it spot on. And do you want to maybe say something about your PhD project or your work that you do there?
Oh, you need a song break.
No. Maybe a song break.
A song break. Yeah, let's go for the song. Stay tuned to hear about Deborah's thesis. Thesis.
Africa. Time to change.
Hello and welcome back. We were just listening to Sounds from the Bush by the Mandingo Griot Society. And before that, we listened to The Hymn of the Forest by Yakuru. And then, now, we're going to listen to... up next, we're listening to Deborah talk about her PhD. Do you have a title yet?
I don't have a title of the dissertation, but it will be... No. Multi-species urbanism. Yeah. It will be about multi-species urbanism.
In Amsterdam?
Yeah, the case study is in Amsterdam. There will be Dutch case studies. Of course, the one of the main case studies will be the food forest, Amsterdam Zuidoost's food forest project, and all of the people that we meet from the municipality, all of the community of practice, they're all going to be a big part of the dissertation, and how we produce multi-species urbanism in which domains are connected to it, and what it means for these different domains, what are the values, what are the methods. So it's going to be about that.
Amazing.
Yeah, just like let me know when to put the defense in my agenda. Really, I already will imagine my dress now.
I was just thinking because when Jacqueline was here, we also said that we're going to visit her in her residency. She has a ceramic residency at the moment. And we also thought of an outfit of going there. And I was like, think covered in mud. Like, oh, yeah. And maybe it would be a similar one.
Yeah. Yeah, so we will have already done a demo before we get to yours, I guess, unless you go really fast.
I want to hack your visit to Jacqueline if we get to wear mud and dirt.
I'm definitely going to send her at least this excerpt from the radio. Jacqueline, we're coming. All right. And then so we're talking about multi-species urbanism and we're talking about this reciprocal relationship and how to hear and care for microbes and soil, living and non-living beings. So I think the radical observation, this is one way, and creating a food forest or a habitat, a world, a safe space for non-living and living beings is another way that you're practicing?
Yes, we're creating for humans more than humans, of which humans are part. But for example, the governance of such a space, for example, you can, as a neighborhood, let's say in Amsterdam and other places in the Netherlands, you can be the, you can do, you can decide, or you can decide, we will take care of this space. We will, you can make a deal with the maintenance agencies of or departments of the city and say, we will see this green strip in front of our house. The all of us neighbors, we're going to take care of this. Mm-hmm. Together, but you can only do it in certain ways and not in other ways, and that's still a problem. There's not a typology for how a certain kind of care that is so differentiated. So the way we're doing it, for example, with this food forest is still experimental. It's to take it out of this system and then the community of practice, or together with Urbani Ahuva as we start to initiate it, we decide what it is, obviously in consultation with certain municipal allies. But I mean, there's not a place in like in those crazy spreadsheets and CAD and HISIP system, it's called HISIP system for maintenance. There's not even a way to describe it infrastructurally, techno-managerially. So there has to. So we have to make new ways. It even gets down to that kind of silly Excel sheet managerialism.
And so, yeah, do you have any other ways that you've been able to give agency to soil or the beings in soil?
Yes. Well, one of the biggest, it's not sewn up perfectly exactly yet, but one of the biggest impacts of the interaction with the municipality by the community of Praxis in this 55 hectare ecological zone is that we have been able and we are in the process of changing the mowing regimes. And that mowing is one of the main ways to dry out. It's the second most impact-rich way to dry out to create drought in your city. And when you mow, you create drought. Another way is to cut down the trees. That also goes on. But we, in this area, we've been able largely to get them to stop mowing and to go to a mowing regime of just once or twice a year.
Maybe it's interesting for the listeners of Amsterdam to know about these facts, because once you were throwing some numbers to me that maybe they're not here today, but like that there are certain areas in the city that are like mowed like certain times a year. Could you say more about that?
Yeah, so a normal mowing regime for these urban lawns, which have the effect of just being like green, like literally
the color green in a neighborhood. You know, they don't. It's not like people are having picnics on them. They're not football fields, which are totally valid ways of using a lawn. I mean, sometimes you need a football field and you need places to picnic and lie in the sun on the grass. No problem. But sometimes it's just some strange aesthetic that developed through the years for not very many good reasons, and definitely not good reasons if it comes to climate crisis. Mm-hmm. And these spaces are, these lawns are sometimes mowed a minimum of 26 times per year. And they're not allowed to have growth over 4 centimeters.
Yeah, talking about this, that we all develop habits and practices that can appear really healthy and beneficial from the outside, like from a personal way to what you do in your community or your family, to your institution, to the whole country. There's these practices that are in our society, and it's nothing to be condemned. It's just how things go. It's part of nature. Yeah, it's also nature, and then, but it's also not a reason to be attached to them and just to like recognize them for that and let them go when we find another way.
This week, Renata Nolan, who's my partner in Urbania Huva, she led a nature walk on these lawns that had been really abused in the Kantershofstraat neighborhood in Amsterdam Zuidoost. And the Balmer. And the first thing she had us do was a radical observation of standing 10 minutes in these between these two trees in this like grass lawn verge along in the middle of a road. And we were just supposed to count plants. And you think, okay, it's just some shitty grass that's been mowed too much and drying out. And in my little zone, I counted 19 different plants.
Wow.
And then she had us, other people were coming also up with these kinds of numbers of just, that's all, that was not planted. That's like all bird and insect work, bringing those seeds in there from the adjacent ecological zones. And she then was talking to us about, you know, when you mow it, you're keeping all these plants in this baby form, and they're not allowed to put out their seeds. They're not allowed to develop their roots into this good soil ecosystem. Some of those plants have really nice, you know, 40 centimeter down roots that will keep the place very moist and cooler and provide nectar all throughout the year in their flowers. And I mean, it's 19 different kinds of plants. There were some places with 22. It was this great exercise. We walked through the whole neighborhood with a group of about 8 of us, I think, just looking at all these places that looked really poor, yeah. But then we gave extra, she focused our attention and told us, you know, if we would not mow this the entire time, if we would choose to not mow it, it would have this effect on the soil organism, this effect on the nature, on the animal, like nectar and butterfly egg laying, and also all these species that are about to become extinct, that don't need to become extinct if we would just change our this one little tiny practice.
Very interesting. It also makes me almost emotional to like, I want to be there and like put a fence for people who would like mow this area. But now I moved to Amsterdam North, and alongside the river there, I just observed that they let the grass, or like more than grass, they let the site really grow high, and then lately they cut it, but then they would let also the hay like stay. Yeah, is this something that you were part of, or like why is it so different there?
This is called gefaseerd maaien. There's a phased mowing, and you can there's many different way approaches to this, but I'm not involved in that, but you can choose.
No, I'm just laughing because I just feel like to talk about like urban gardening, you need to be some kind of expert in mowing. Like there's all these different phrases for different types of mowing and different cycles, and Yeah, and you got to know the lingo. Like, you got to know the lingo. Like, there's a jargon here. Like, I am in over my head in the mowing.
Well, there's and there's also different opinions about what's better, you know, how much and so forth. And but at
well,
least
if multi-species doesn't work out, then maybe you can go with multi-mowing.
Yeah. but I mean, you need. Yeah, I mean, what they're doing in these areas is they're leaving a place for, like, they're not mowing it all at once, for example. They leave the material so that seeds can fall out, so that insects have a habitat for a longer period of time. I personally would do it a little bit differently, but that doesn't matter. I mean, at least this is better than the 26th time a year mowing.
It also helps then that it's not, because it was a very hot days and they cut the grass, and I also thought, ooh, that's going to be very dry quickly. But then this also protects the soil, I guess. Yeah. Like Tanya sent me a few weeks ago a text, and now I think now it's the time to throw it into the radio. It's a wonderful short text. Do you feel like reading it, Tanya? Let's use the jargon, like, or maybe, yeah, let's read it together. So I read it at home already, and I live with also two native English speakers, and I just didn't know most of the words, but now we're gonna dive into it. So what is the title of the text?
A Mown Lawn by Lydia Davis.
Nice. So I'm gonna read the first two sentences or so. She hated a mown lawn. Maybe that was because mow was the reverse of womb. Womb, the beginning of the name of what she was, a woman.
A mown lawn had a sad sound to it, like a long moan. From her, a mown lawn made a long moan. Lawn had some of the letters of man, though the reverse of man would be nam, a bad war, a raw war. Lawn also contained the letters of law. In fact, lawn was a contraction of lawman. Certainly a lawman could and did mow a lawn.
Law and order could be seen as starting from lawn order, valued by so many Americans. More lawn could be made using a lawn mower. A lawnmower did make more lawn. More lawn was a contraction of more lawmen. Did more lawn in America make more lawmen in America? Did more lawn make more nam? More mown lawn made more long moan from her, or a lawn mourn.
So often, she said, Americans wanted more mown lawn. All of America might be one long mown lawn. A lawn not mown grows long, she said. Better a long lawn. Sorry. Better, she said, a long lawn.
Better a long lawn and a mole. Let the lawman have the mown lawn, she said, or the moron, the lawn moron.
That was maybe really the moment for this text. I'm so happy you shared this and it came back. I also didn't plan that we talk about mown today and lawning, but this was just so inspiring. Thank you two so much for this session. In one part, I really felt like I'm now in a great podcast that I just really want to listen, you know? I just feel very inspired and honored to be here with you too.
I just want to echo everything you just said, and I really enjoyed today, and I found the topic just so easily so easy to just genuinely feel engaged and interested and excited. And I'm super excited to have learned more about you and your work. And I'm just honored and like so happy to hear that this is the work that you're doing, yeah, and that this work is being done.
Yeah,
so thank you for doing the work.
You're welcome, but thank you also. And also, this is the work of many, many hands and many paws and many things, many single cell organisms that are uncountable, but also many humans. And thank you so much for inviting me and giving me this opportunity today. Beautiful. Thank you.
I almost want to say we want to have Deborah back, but we're going to plan on that maybe with people from the gemeente, because there is interesting people at the gemeente that we need maybe in here. But you're going to hear about that. And also, if you want to listen back to the whole series, you can do so. We
binge listen.
We put them all on Mixcloud, and also we attach some links to it of texts that we referred to or the songs that we played. Yeah. It's on Mixcloud/soilmatters.com. Something like this, but you're gonna find it. Yeah, Mixcloud/soilmatters. And also, if you want to write us an email about questions or texts that you would like to talk about here on the radio, then it's soil_series@riseup.net.
Yeah. Cool. Well, hear you next week, and hope you have a great weekend. And thank you so much for listening to us. Thank you, Radio Patapu, for having us, and so much looking forward to next week. Ciao, ciao.